Hello, everyone, and welcome to Awakening the Impulse to Evolve. My name is Craig Hamilton, and I'm the founder of Integral Enlightenment, the organization producing this event. And I'm delighted to have you with us for session 7 of our series featuring Terry Patton. The way the event's going to work tonight is that Terry and I will dialogue for about an hour. Then Terry will spend half an hour taking your questions. And then after that, we'll have our virtual evolutionary cafe where you can dial in on a separate number. It's also free. It's just we need to use a different conferencing service for that. You can dial in and join with others in a small group conversation about the topics discussed tonight. And we do this every week after the teleseminar. So if you're looking for some evolutionary engagement with your fellow evolutionaries, people are really enjoying it, those who have been attending. And if you haven't yet found out about that or gotten yourself set up for that, in the email that we sent you today or earlier this week, you can find information about where to go to create a personal PIN code, which then allows you to dial in and participate in a conversation. So hope to see a lot of you there. All right. Well, it's a real pleasure for me to be here with my good friend and fellow evolutionary Terry Patton this evening. For those of you who don't know Terry, he's a vital and leading voice in the field of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, spirituality. He speaks and consults internationally, inspiring, challenging, and connecting integral evolutionary leaders and institutions worldwide. He's a gifted communicator, a community builder, a successful entrepreneur, and the author of 4 books. And he's worked for over 3 decades as a philosopher, activist, coach, consultant, and teacher, helping leaders embody higher consciousness and practical actions that transform complex systems. He's the author of a book many of you may know, which he wrote with Ken Wilber, called Integral Life Practice. He's also a founding member of Integral Institute and the co-founder of Bay Area Integral. And one of the things I love most about Terry is his rare combination of authentic spiritual depth with a passionate world-based activism. In other words, Terry really lives from a very deep place in himself, and yet his attention and his heart are fully looking outward at the same time, engaged with the work of evolving the world, which I guess in many ways sort of defines what it is to be an evolutionary. So Terry, welcome to Awakening the Impulse to Evolve. It's really great to have you with us.
Thank you so much. What a generous introduction, Craig. Thank you for all you said.
Yeah, absolutely. So to tee this up a little bit, one of the things that we're exploring in this series is the reality that many of us today are awakening to a new kind of spiritual impulse. And when I say a new kind, what I mean is that, you know, traditionally when somebody became deeply serious about their spirituality, there was a tendency, an almost universal tendency, to want to leave the world of activity and action and commerce and social life and engagement and withdraw into either, you know, the cave or the mountaintop or the monastery or the ashram, but in some way get out of the world of busyness and activity and go and dive deep into the deeper dimensions of being. And yet many people today are feeling this equally deep spiritual impulse to really want to transform and evolve, but it's not one that's taking us out of the world, but in many ways seems to be propelling us into a deeper engagement, a full evolutionary kind of engagement with the world. And so, you know, it occurred to me today as I was preparing for our dialogue that in this new kind of evolutionary spirituality, that the dichotomy between doing inner transformative work on oneself on one hand and then doing outer work to help transform the world on the other, in some sense seems to disappear in this new kind of evolutionary awakening that's happening, that these two seemingly different impulses ultimately become part of a single movement or expressions of a single impulse, what Andrew Cohen calls the evolutionary impulse. And when I think about you and how I see you living your own life, because I know you very well, I see you as very much an example of someone who is animated by this evolutionary impulse. And in that animation, that you're driven both to profound inner spiritual work and passionate outer work to evolve the world in a way that seems very integral and unified. So I thought it would be a really interesting way to begin to just by inviting you to speak about your own experience of this evolutionary impulse that's driving you. What is it in your own inner life? How do you experience it?
Thank you. Thank you, Craig. That's a... You know, I was reflecting on
an easy question.
Yeah, it's very deep because we're dealing with some very profound issues. There are there's a venerable tradition of enlightenment and real awakenings that express themselves in very dynamic ways in life. You know, Bodhidharma advised the emperor, and there are all kinds of examples of awakened leadership. Solon advised Epimenides, I think it was. Anyway, the early examples were that the superior awakened being took a leadership role in the affairs of the whole community. But over time, a different model evolved in which it seemed that awakening was supposed to be about transcending the confused affair of life. And I know for me, my path took me through this, you know, which is it? What is the truth? You know, many, many times. I was raised in an ethic of social activism by parents who were involved in the postmodern awakening of a sense of larger social commitment. And in their own framing, although there was no deep esoteric spiritual realization that was a part of their experience, that they thought of their activism as being spiritually based. I felt an emptiness because there wasn't any real realization, no mystical profundity in that upbringing, even though it had a social commitment. And I found a teacher, Adi Da Samraj, who's a truly great realizer, who brought a profundity of presencing a divine siddhi, you might say, a transcendental power that was almost a palpable force. And that was a huge transformational influence for me. Now, he is prolific and eloquent, and he says many things, including speaking ideas that are very evolutionary and leading edge in all of those ways, and also speaking in a more traditional way about enlightenment. As I woke up, the people who were my friends and in the cohort that I was involved with, didn't feel a sense of evolutionary urgency in the way that I did. And I often found myself out kind of alone as an outlier because for me, the more I rested in the peace that passeth understanding, the more excited I got and more of a sense of urgency arose for me about finding a way to have that make a profound difference in the outer world. But because I was alone, you know, I questioned that. And I have seen many people who have ridden this as an actual dilemma in their lives, and I've counseled people about it, because it is easy to confuse a kind of idealistic urgency that we feel because of a relatively mental and abstract sense of connection to the whole and an ability to think from a world-centric place. But where we're still anxious and in dilemma and where we're kind of bringing the anxiety and the ego disturbance of a mentally focused orientation into life, and you know, we see so much of that confusion in the activist communities. I think after there is some measure of realization of a fundamental freedom, a different kind of urgency returns that transcends the earlier dilemma-based urgency. And distinguishing between those two might be a really important point in understanding what drives a truly awakened approach to an evolutionary commitment. We really have to be in this because it's just what we do. What else is there to do in a place of freedom and no dilemma and, in a sense, not being confined by our own frightened destiny? What else is there to do? And I think from that place, a different kind of creativity can flow. And it's been very exciting for me to discover myself once again an activist in a way alive in some of the same kinds of principles that I was raised in, but from such a radically different perspective, in which a certain kind of joy and liberated energy, a contact with a higher sense of power and freedom and fullness and peace is underneath the whole process.
Well, I mean, this is a really great point you bring up, and I do agree with you that it's something worth unpacking a little bit because, you know, in our contemporary alternative pop spiritual climate, most of the ideas we have about spirituality in some way, and I'm speaking really broad strokes, but I'm sure everybody will be able to relate to some degree to this, that most of the spiritual ideas in circulation, in some way, at least those that are talking about enlightenment or liberation or self-realization, God-realization, that the vision of what that means is generally cast in some way as, you know, as a kind of absence of motive, almost, that in some sense we come to this beatific place of peace with all that is. We're loving what is, we're accepting what is, we're simply abiding in the moment. We're coming to this place of just simple kind of, just kind of to rest in a certain way, and just kind of contentment. And the notion that, you know, that there could be something like passion, strong motive, agenda on the other side of awakening is, I mean, it, you know, again, it's not something that no one else is saying, but it is generally kind of at odds in many ways with, I think, the picture a lot of us have been given about what this is supposed to be about. You know, we think, well, if you really want something, that's your ego, man. Or if you're really passionate about something, well, who's passionate? You know, who's that person? So obviously that's your ego, your smaller self. What, you know, you obviously haven't woken up yet if you're still, you know, wanting or driven to make something happen in this world. And so I just think it would be great to go a little deeper into is that? You know? What is that? Urgency.
I think that's a beautiful opening to say something about the most basic idea in integral theory, that of the four quadrants. If an enlightenment is a real enlightenment, it's a whole being enlightenment, and therefore it's going to show up in every domain of life. It isn't just subjective. It isn't just an ability to commune. It isn't just a kind of virtuousness in one's behavior. It's actually a dynamism that reaches out and is an enactment of this potently in all dimensions, even changing potentially the systems that we're a part of. And I think we live in a time in which things are moving so rapidly and there's such an evolution of the relative world that the absolute consciousness that is awakened and which is finding itself coincident with all the life changes and evolutionary shifts and processes of our relative world is having to show up in with so much more complexity and so much more dynamism and move so much more quickly. Evolution itself is evolving. Enlightenment itself is evolving. The whole matter is happening in our lifetimes in a way that's unprecedented. So there's a call upon every being, and it's one that we can consciously engage to the degree that we have free consciousness, that has to do with turning an evolutionary corner in a larger sense right now. If we're really awakened, we're in communion with this whole planet, with thousands and thousands of species, many of whom are going extinct in the biggest mass extinction since the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. This is all going on in our lifetime. And we can be free and at peace, and in the midst of that, drawn up in a kind of tender... See, part of the peace of enlightenment is not an immunity. It's almost a vulnerability that doesn't hold back. I mean, everything registers and is felt deeply. I think that there is an unfolding of awakening that goes very, very far. In some ways, I stand absolutely free compared to where I once stood, but I've met beings who are free and powerful in a way that goes beyond my own awakening. I'm in a path that never ends. I am a traveler on a path in which enlightenment is true and is always becoming truer. As awakened as I am, I've only become more and more vulnerable, more and more able to bear, to feel the incredible the pain of the whole world registers, and in this time of bumping into evolutionary limits, it's just an exquisitely poignant context for our whole lives. And a liberated care is just moved to action. It isn't even something you have to think about. It's the way that people who know each other and live together, they finish the meal and they just start cleaning up. I feel like it's kind of like that. There's not a way of having to think about it and think there's a problem that we're going to solve. It's just a spontaneous response in a vulnerable connection to the moment we're in all together.
Mm. This brings up something else that I want to dig into a little bit, which is that, you know, a few minutes ago you spoke about that on the other side of that what you were calling liberation from dilemma, like getting beyond the basic ego or self-contracted posture of there's a problem, you know, I don't fit, the world doesn't fit, there's something fundamentally wrong, and all of the existential angst that comes with that and contraction away from life. So you were saying getting beyond that, then part and parcel of that is not just a kind of peace and liberation and contentment with what is, but that inherent in it, you said, there's urgency. And to what degree do you feel this evolutionary urgency is a response to current life conditions, what you were just talking about, right? There's a lot of crises. If we get related to the kind of pain that we're causing to other species, to the biosphere, to each other, that is a catalyst for an evolutionary kind of awakening. But to what degree is it a response to the global crisis, and that's really what's driving this kind of evolutionary awakening? Or to what degree is it something that's inherent in the process itself and is just inherent in awakening that there is this kind of passion and urgency?
I think it's inherent in awakening. I don't think it is. There's always something to do, and this particular crisis has a peculiar character, and we can't really see what it's like to be in this moment without the context that we're in. We're here.
Right.
On the other hand, I think we are simply drawn up in service of something greater. I think that some of the great realizers that we look to as models awoke in an era, even very, you know, Ramana Maharshi only lived a generation ago, and he's one of the great models of awakening. And, hey, he just sat and did nothing, essentially, his whole life, and in the process changed the world and offered something great to all of us. But in that moment in time, demonstrating a radical heart awakening that was so potent that you could just look into the eyes of his photograph and feel it, was a contribution to evolution. There is a different moment that we're in. And in this moment, a kind of dynamism about cultural evolution and a collective consciousness that's emerging all begin to be possible, and for me, as you know, as I experience it, necessary. I don't know that generalizations about how it has to show up for others are always true. There are many unique individuals. You know, there may be an individual as unique as Ramana who's showing up now, who's going to find a way of expressing awakening that will be different from anything you and I are talking about. There's got to be room in our model to have surprise and wonder. But as we've talked about very deeply in our own conversations, it's been a liberation to feel an obligation to something greater than ourselves. It would feel like a burden to try to fulfill ourselves as egos. What a drag that would be. in a way, we're freed up to be at the service of something greater than ourselves. It lends life meaning, dignity, purpose, clarity. For me, even the subtle energetic circuits of my own being have found themselves engaging in a giving and a receiving in relation to trying to be of service to every human being, every heart that I coach or serve in teaching events or anything. And in that process, new gifts arrive for me. The more I give, the more connected I am, the more on purpose I am. And it's a self-fulfilling, self-perpetuating a virtuous cycle instead of a vicious cycle, you know, a positive feedback loop of kind of clarity and service.
Mm. Yeah, well, that really comes through in your life, Terry. So another area kind of more broadly I want to dig into is, this series is about evolutionary spirituality. What is this new evolutionary spirituality that's emerging? People are speaking about it from many different angles, from the more sort of great story angle of giving birth to a new myth to help give meaning, help us understand the actual meaning and purpose of our human lives at this time, and all the way to what we're talking about here, which is in many ways the more mystical or esoteric experiential dimension of awakening to the evolutionary impulse and starting to become animated by something other than the personal self. And so you're somebody who's very passionate about evolutionary spirituality, very lit up by the evolutionary impulse. You're also an integralist par excellence, deeply studied in integral theory and a teacher of that. And so there's integral spirituality, there's evolutionary spirituality. And from your point of view, to what degree are those the same thing? To what degree are they different parts of a broader movement? You know, I sometimes have people ask me, does integral theory or integral spirituality have to include evolution, or could you have it without it? Or, you know, is integral spirituality a subset of this broader evolutionary spirituality? So how do you see these two different major contributions to the what we might call the leading edge of spiritual inquiry right now?
There's a lot to explore there, Craig. Thanks. Well, first of all, integral theory would have it that culture evolves and that beyond the postmodern stage of cultural development, a new wave of more nuanced, complex meaning-making and new set of values and a new disposition just naturally evolves. And Ken has called that the integral wave, and there are several waves beyond the first integral wave, but you might say there's three identified integral stages of consciousness. This awareness of evolution and this telling of the tale of evolution and being inspired by it and thinking systemically is a textbook case of what the integral theory would account for as integral consciousness. So evolutionary spirituality and evolutionary just being inspired by the great story, you know, these are the kinds of things that someone at an integral stage of consciousness would naturally feel. From an evolutionary perspective, we have to begin to take a new kind of responsibility in this moment. The evolutionary perspective sees our moment with a real sense of urgency and responsibility, I think, inherently, whether that's awakened or not. The evolutionary is, you know, that's why we use that word, evolutionary. It rhymes with revolutionary. There's a sort of active, passionate commitment implicit in it. And that urgency is not always present among people who are struck by the importance of integral theory. To me, that's an expression of an immature level of integral involvement. I think that when we really take the integral, the implications of the integral model to heart, the evolutionary disposition ends up coinciding. So although there's a body of conversation we call integral and a body of conversation we call evolutionary, they significantly overlap. I think that the highest expressions of the evolutionary approach are inherently integral, and they are really served by a familiarity and use of integral theory and integral life practice, all the things that my work centers on. So to me, the essence of each is the shared space that includes both.
Okay. And so to what degree, because, you know, this is an interesting question for me personally, because, you know, last summer I did the Great Integral Awakening series, which was a similar series to this, 14 parts, focused entirely on integral spirituality. And when I had completed that, I realized that there were a bunch of people who I felt were part of the movement of evolutionary spirituality, but that I wouldn't have included in that series because they didn't seem to be integralists or led up with the integral worldview per se. And that's what compelled me to then do this series, because I also have a foot in both camps, or, you know, emerge kind of out of this shared space that they're in, as you said. And yet in this series I included some of both, because you were in the previous series as well, as was Ken Wilber and Andrew Cohen and a number of others. But also, you know, there are a number of people here who, so there are, the reason I'm saying that there are a number of people who are very excited about the evolutionary story, what it means for our spirituality, who have not, you know, don't necessarily feel compelled in any way to embrace what you or me might call the integral worldview. What's the case for the integration of these two into one?
You mean what would I say to someone who's a passionate evolutionary who's not so turned on by integral theory?
Yeah, hasn't really gotten why is that so relevant?
Uh-huh.
And integral spirituality, and why is its contribution important?
Yeah, okay, so each of them. Well, I think that integral theory offers a psychoactive view of the world that puts together so much. It offers us an integration that is clarifying and catalytic and enlightening. I think that Ken Wilber's particular formulation of it is brilliant and really useful. Not everyone, many people, myself included, and you too, you know, love his writings, but some people don't respond as easily to the 50,000-foot view that he offers. On the other hand, there are other Integral Writers, what I've offered in collaboration with Ken in Integral Life Practice has reached some people that haven't read his other books, Steve McIntosh's writings, Spiral Dynamics, Don Beck's. There are other integral offerings that do reach some of those folks. And partly what they begin to get is that we live in a world in which multiple perspectives are always going to coexist, and we begin to understand something about the very structure of those perspectives. And we also then begin to appreciate that most human conversations are only engaging in an aspect of that larger whole. And we can kind of see the whole crystal and see how all these facets fit together in a way that liberates us into contact with the seamless fabric that all the parts are really all in touch with. They're all right, but partial, true but partial. That's one of the wonderful one-line summaries of integral theory, that every perspective is true, but every perspective is also partial. And that lets us participate in a lot of perspectives in a freer way and also have a more inclusive awareness that enables us to have really rigorous and amazing discourse at a very high level. So I'm just so grateful to Ken. I think that we all do well to learn aqual theory, all quadrant, all level, all line, all state, all type is what aqual stands for. It's kind of Ken's basic theoretical framework. It gives us a marvelous operating system, marvelous vocabulary or language for having such nuanced conversations. I think it just furthers the whole enterprise marvelously. Mm. And so I'm an advocate for that. But I'm also very aware that not everyone will speak that language, and it is even an implication of integral theory that a good integral practitioner will learn to speak a lot of other languages, not just that one. And the thing that I appreciate about the evolutionary conversation is that it is an activist engagement. It has a big view. It really inheriting a sense of the fact that we are in motion in the midst of a great story right now, right here. And our generation, in a way that really is different than what went before. But there's an interesting side controversy. Some caller may say, "What makes you think we're different? How grandiose is that?" But before I answer that objection, let me make the central point, which is things have sped up and sped up and sped up in evolution. The leap to where human cultural evolution became consequential and perhaps and even probably on an evolutionary scale. What happens in our cultural evolution matters even to the evolution of our biosphere. And that has been accelerating so rapidly that in our lifetimes, culture has evolved and will be evolving. And by participating in that cultural evolution right now, what we do can matter. That confers an opportunity and therefore a responsibility for a kind of enlightened participation. We don't always know how we're going to affect the larger whole, but we have a sense of relevance and of not just being bystanders. And my God, we've been offered an incarnation, a birth, at a time when stuff that really matters is happening. We may be only 1/6 billionth of the human population, but we're in the action. And if this human cultural organism is going to grow to a new level of responsibility and sustainability and compassion and clarity and be able to give birth to a positive evolutionary future, what happens in our lifetimes matters. And so that sense of responsibility and urgency and connectedness to the whole through deep time and even ecologically is beautiful, true, necessary. Mm. And what that evolutionary view brings, I think, especially when it integrates with that integral offering, is to me the new spirituality. We might call it spirituality, but to me it's humanity. It's just showing up conscious and whole, embodied and feeling and engaging with, you know, holding nothing back. I mean, we can call that spirituality. It's sort of just real life. that's integral and evolutionary. Mm-hmm. It's not more one or more the other, and making one a subset of the other. You know, each of them are inclusive enough to make each other a subset and want to, and somebody wants to have that argument, but not me.
we'll save that one for the Facebook forum. Okay. That was really beautiful. And so, you know, right just then, you gave a really, you know, powerful, passionate articulation of our the exigencies of our evolutionary moment, of what and what those can call forth from us, what they confer upon us. And everything you just said, it's possible to relate to all that mentally from the sense of our, you know, egoic, contracted self, to feel like that's all a good idea, say all that, to be excited by it, but as you said at the beginning, perhaps in a way that is kind of grounded still in our fundamental anxiety, etc. And I want to just invite you to drill deeper into the distinction, because so it's possible to just sort of intellectually get everything you just said, to see that. That's what's apparent if we look, and we can see all that, and that alone can awaken a lot of many people have been awakened by that reality to a kind of new passion for life and wanting to participate. But I know you're speaking about something more. The title of our talk tonight is Tapping into the Energy of Evolution, and about how this energy, this source of cosmic power, in a sense, that transcends our mortal self, it can revolutionize our entire life in myriad ways. And so I'd like to know more about, from your point of view and your experience, of what that impulse is, what that energy is, and then also, what is it that awakens that? Is it just reflecting and contemplating on this greater context? Is it something else that can awaken us to that power? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are really good questions. I think, you know, I want to thank you, and in a sense thank being, to be having such a passionate conversation, to my knowledge, right at the leading edge of a larger human conversation that seems to be advancing rapidly, you know, in our own time.
Mm, mm.
I feel very alive in this. And as I engage it, I feel a relationship to the source energy, the source of the life force in my own body. You know, the sinoatrial node of my heart keeps beating every moment. And where that energy of that heartbeat comes from, science has never found. What is that? There's something about the animating energetics of this body-mind are being powered by mystery, the great capital M, mystery of being, you know, which is what I mean when I say God or divine. And that mystery is my deepest intimate. I'm being lived by that one. My heart's being beaten by that one. Now, that's feeling that and feeling intimate with that, feeling aligned to that, feeling connected to that is a power source. But then I also feel drawn by a positive evolutionary future, by a future where the human family finds a way to get beyond its simple quarreling and turns a corner at a critical time, perhaps in my lifetime or soon thereafter, where an unsustainable, overheated, conflictual pattern of living that is rooted in deep, hardwired evolutionary impulses manages to discipline itself enough so that the highest fruits of our evolution in culture and consciousness are preserved, and they keep evolving. And they evolve not just for another 100 years, not just for another 1,000 years, but the way forward is vaster than the way behind. If we think in terms of deep time forward, what is the glorious, positive evolutionary future? What are the species we give birth to that transcend us, that are more good, true, and beautiful than we are? What kind of human culture arises from what's best in us right now? That is calling on me right now. That wants to be born. I can be a receptor for the call of that positive evolutionary possibility, like the strange attractor that is the destiny point that gives order to a chaotic vat of chemicals that turns into an orderly system. I can be the receptor for, in this chaotic moment, for a new order that wants to find its way into our current chaos. And feeling called by that is a source of energy too. So I'm both powered by and called by an it's like an energetic link up, a kind of circuitry. And the more I can align myself to that and just get out of the way of what wants to happen, of what, you know, what that positive evolutionary future wants to draw from the core of being itself through the each of my heartbeats out into the, you know, the gifts of love and service that can make a difference. That makes sense of this insanity for me.
Oh, that's beautiful. But there's another question right on the heels of that, though, which is, because again, I'm kind of trying to push into this. Well, what is it? Where does it come from? How do we tap into it? Why does it? But this particular question is, so why does that kind of evolutionary passion that you're talking about, this burning evolutionary urgency, why does that awaken in some people and not others? Because, for instance, there are by now probably tens, if not hundreds of hundreds of thousands of people who have done a lot of, in the contemporary West, who've done a lot of spiritual practice. Many people have meditated for 30 years, been to lots of satsangs, really been on the path for a long time, and would not describe their own experience as having been blown open and you know, with this burning passion to evolve. Many people say, oh, you know, that the fruit of my practice is that I've become more at peace with who I am, more at peace with what's happening, more able to accept reality as it comes to me. And those are genuine fruits of practice, but they're not the same thing as this kind of surging high voltage evolutionary awakening that you're talking about. And so what do you think it is in your experience in yourself, but also in working with other people, that is the extra piece that catalyzes this entire other order of awakening?
Well, I mean, those are really good questions to contemplate. I would say, first of all, that the people I know who've practiced for a long period of time and who have really come to a kind of peace are usually pretty loving people who in different ways are affecting the people around them in a way that is doing some real good. And to the degree that their peace and their serenity are broadcasting themselves into the world, I think they are agents of something evolutionary. I mean, I can make some distinctions between me and them, but I'm also interested in the things that we have in common. And my appreciation and love and respect for them is sort of the first foot forward into considering them for me.
Indeed.
Then I also feel that they probably haven't deeply combined themselves with the consideration that we have combined ourselves with, that you're serving through this interview series. I think most of them haven't paid attention. They've just been intuitively attracted to the kinds of awakenings that are ancient. They've wanted to have the credibility and the kind of venerable, the community has tested it over thousands of years, kind of feeling that you can have about some of the Buddhist and Hindu paths, and they feel a kind of trust in that new ideas, newfangled ideas, they, you know, this is coming into fashion, it may go out of fashion. You know, there's a kind of conservatism.
Mm.
So they haven't really felt like they had to take this to heart. They haven't felt, they haven't heard it in a way that honored it as possibly profound and important yet.
Mm.
I think if they did, it would find fertile ground in many of them. I look at them as not yet colleagues in the evolutionary process, not as different species.
Hmm.
I think that, you know, I had an interesting conversation with Andrew Cohen about this just last week, and we were kind of debating this point, this very point, because Andrew said he thought that some people have a culturally conditioned predisposition to a kind of awakening that is simply free of the strife and seeking and dilemma that previously pertained, whereas others are more oriented to action, to enlightened service, to
also through a culturally conditioned predisposition.
He seemed to be saying that,
yeah.
And I was, I don't know that I would trust my translation of Andrew's perspective 100%. He should speak for himself, you know, and he's a pretty smart guy, so he might make some important, you know, finer distinctions, but that's what I basically understood. Now, I responded by saying, to me, when I really let go into, when I awaken, let go, arrive, in the deepest samadhi, for me, that samadhi is completely peaceful. It never needs to come to an end. But emerging from it, I am just more given over, more feeling a transcendental, righteous urgency, a kind of joy in giving whatever I can. It's a little like feeling connected up to the... to the bigger, awakening sort of puts me on the court. It's a little like the awakening gives you court time. It just takes me from being a bystander who's kind of trying to figure this out and you know, thinking it through or trying to feel what feels better to me. And suddenly, it's not about me at all. There's this larger need that's calling on all of us. I'm swimming down this evolutionary river toward this positive evolutionary future that wants to find its way into the world through every one of us. So I include everybody in that. And for me, it's a let yourself feel it and it will come. I can't separate my awakening into the... See, there are awakenings that are just subjective, but my teacher Adi Da really beautifully and eloquently makes the point that the enlightenment is an enlightenment of the whole body, it's an enlightenment of the whole being, and it has to show up in every area of life. I think that the subjective enlightenment that goes off in a cave is, I mean, it's a beautiful thing, and it's a part of what we need in order to, you know, the teachings that have come out of that have fed our process culturally. They've conferred some value. I'm glad we have them. I don't want, and the people who've really done that work are amazingly developed. They're more developed than I am in the thing they're most developed in, and I really respect them. I don't want to, you know, one of the things that I think is a liability of the evolutionary and integral conversations is because we see so many new things and we're so excited about them, we can seem to be arrogantly, you know, it's kind of like adolescents dissing the elders, you know,
right,
saying we
right.
know better than they do.
Sure.
And it's important that we not fall into that. On the other hand, and we should acknowledge that many of them have done amazing sadhana, amazing spiritual practice. They've endured incredible heat, tapas. They've transfigured their body minds. They are the presence of something utterly good, true, and beautiful that only should be honored. And I think that we can have that respect and still see what we see, feel what we feel, be an advocate for the clarity of an evolutionary and integral view. I don't I don't think that we're stuck with the alternative of being arrogant adolescents or falling into line with an awakening that would happily wander into extinction.
Right. Great stuff, Terry. So you're a coach, a transformative coach, integral coach. You work with people one-on-one. You're also a teacher. You work with groups. You work with leaders. So how, and you wrote this great book, Integral Life Practice, which is a, what is it, 21st century blueprint for, I'm not going to remember the subtitle, whole body,
physical health, emotional balance, mental clarity, and spiritual awakening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
full spectrum.
Okay. So then it just takes me then also to the how-to question for the practitioner, because you're saying we can tap into this energy of evolution and it can change everything for us because it's such a it's an energy and a power arising from a different center, a different order than what we might consider our own personal body mind, our
well, yeah. I mean, I really think that I'm not.
How do we do it?
Yeah,
how does one do it? How does one tap into that?
Well, let me say, you know, the spiritual traditions really, some of them describe esoteric yogas, and basically what they're talking about is that we are not just a gross physical body, we're also a subtle energetic body. And the kinds of circuitry and connectedness that tend to animate us can be changed by our spiritual work, by our meditation, by our service, by our transcendence of our egoic motives, by our heartfelt loving, by our devotion, by our work. That aligns and clarifies the whole being and helps the degenerative circuitry and the less healthy dynamics of the way we're living out our as energetic systems, and they help us align more and more to the transcendental. There's a light above your head, and you're drawing that into your body through your frontal line with every time you inhale, and there is a way that the life current at the base of your spine opens and rises up the spine all the time. And maybe only a tiny trickle usually does that, but as you practice, more and more does. And you are shifted by that. And that's not the only kind of yoga. It's a yoga of the heart in which we move from gross to subtle to causal. There's a reconfiguring. And as we practice, we tap into a bigger and bigger energy. And this happens in a very ordinary way that people aren't always trying to do. It's a natural outgrowth of living a loving and healthy life with a certain amount of self-discipline and real study and clarity in which you are connecting with what is greater than yourself. It can happen without your conscious awareness to some degree, but it can even be magnified more. And it's been my experience, because I did some of these yogas in a very specific way with a great teacher, that as I connected with that larger energy more and more, it flowed through me in different ways. And, you know, the story of the Kundalini is that it sometimes causes all kinds of disturbance, too. It's not just a simple harmonizer with no upsets. You know, you can have some challenges. There's an ordeal to the process of growth. It's not just a simple, easy, benign. Well, it's benign, but it requires you to participate and to take some rough corners in this whitewater rafting affair. But as that yoga opens more, you do tap into a larger energy. And the more that you let yourself be of service to something larger than yourself, the more you let yourself be lived by this divine mystery in relation to where this divine mystery wants to go. I don't really know exactly what it wants to do, but it is clear to me that at least as much as I'm able to discern it, it wants to move toward a positive evolutionary future. I don't even know if we're going to succeed. For all I know, we're having this conversation at a time when we might have already passed some horrible point of no return and we're headed to a new dark age, no matter what you or I do. I don't know for sure, but I know for sure that this energy wants me to believe in it and to do everything I can to serve it. And so I am at peace if I just do everything I can. I'm not seized by anxiety because I don't know the outcome of this evolutionary horse race.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to handicap it. I just have to give myself unreservedly, and then I'm connected to that larger flow. And that positive, attractive force of a more loving, more creative, more dynamic, more beautiful evolutionary future. You know, I see that. I just glanced at my wall. I have a picture of Ramana Maharshi, who I was just talking about. When I look in his eyes, I see an utter peace that needs nothing, and I also see a wise and clear and positive evolutionary future looking back at me, even through those ancient eyes that, you know, he never thought it was necessary to do anything but sit and be the self. Well, the self, through him, is now, as it finds its way through the prism of this body-mind in 2010, wanting to, it's like a rose wanting to bloom or an acorn wanting to be an oak. This human experiment wants to fulfill an incomprehensible, glorious destiny that is absolutely enlightened. What if we had a whole society of awakened people? What if the different kinds of creativity that are unique to us found expression at the highest levels that you can only have when you're really highly, highly developed? What if we were all doing these marvelous yogas? You know, something like that could evolve in 5 or 10,000 years. Maybe we can help be the bridge to that.
Amen. Terry, that's fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. May it be so. Yeah, and particularly your point about we don't get to know where we are in that. We don't get to know for sure whether it's going to matter, but that does not in any way slow down the urgency, the imperative of the impulse and of living in alignment with it. And there's a beautiful kind of freedom in what you just expressed, because, you know, right, one of the essential elements of freedom, go back to the Bhagavad Gita, speaking of traditions, is, right, freedom from attachment to outcome. Everybody quotes it from the Gita, right?
Right.
And this is like a new evolutionary version of that, where, you know, I'll participate in evolution if I know we're all going to make it and everything's going to be good in my lifetime or beyond. It's like I participate.
Yeah, no deal.
It has to happen.
It has to happen. Right on, Craig.
Yeah, really.
And the other thing that's so great about mentioning the Gita is at the end, Krishna says, remember me, Arjuna. And by me, he means, you know, those eyes I was looking into with Ramana. He means what I encountered in Adida. He means the God who has loved you beyond yourself. He means the very presence of the living God, the most inspiring, amazing heart of being. Remember that and engage. Serve. Mm-hmm. Give it your best. Fight, in that sense. Engage the struggle of this unknowable. You know, we're in an insanely difficult crisis right now. This human circumstance. Look what happened at Copenhagen. Right now, it's a time when a lot of environmentalists who are doing necessary work. This is another thing that, you know, comes to mind for me, Craig, that I hope we can surface at least briefly, which is that this evolutionary integral enterprise that we're a part of implies great works, and we don't quite have them yet. We're trying to evolve a clarity in a kind of leading tip of culture and consciousness, a kind of commitment, a kind of inspiration, and that's really important and that's necessary. But when we are doing when we have our Integral Evolutionary Red Cross, our Integral Evolutionary Catholic Charities, our Integral Evolutionary projects of service that are meta-systemic, that don't just go to Haiti and give them a fish, but teach them how to fish, metaphorically, that, that create meta-systemic changes that are full of that care, but which are able to operate, you know, out of compassion in a way that makes a difference in the affairs of people. When people see good works originating from a meta-systemic disposition actually having an impact on the world, the number of people who are going to be graduating into integral levels of consciousness rapidly is going to blow our minds. When we have that killer app, the whole game is going to change. And it's part of our job to care that we don't have it yet, to be living in the koan, the necessity of evolving it and finding a way to manifest it. So that's one of the things I hope that the folks who are listening in on this call will feel is, how could we create a different level of good works? What would that be? Because the conversation out of which we evolve some things that really make a difference is probably one of the most critical things we could be doing.
Mm. Now, that's a great call to end this part of the dialogue with, because, yeah, I think we all, you know, I feel that. I feel the imperative of that. I feel the lack of that from this movement at this point. And may we all feel it as a goad to our deepening inquiry into all that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you, Craig. Yeah.
Yeah. So before we move into the question and answer section, I know we've got a lot of people who are going to want to ask you questions, but I just want to hear a little bit about how people can connect with you. You're available for private coaching. We can learn more about that at your website, integralheart.com. But I know you also have a free guided meditation that people can download to get a sense of this approach you're calling integral practice on the three faces of spirit. And that's at integralpractice.com. So if you visit integralpractice.com, you can download a half-hour guided meditation for free that Terry's put together. It's in some ways an introduction to one of the deeper pieces of this spiritual work that you teach. Is there anything else you want to mention about what you're doing or how people can connect with you?
Yeah, well, just those two websites, Craig, integralpractice.com and integralheart.com. Integralpractice.com is just something I've just set up for this guided meditation on the three faces of God. Integral Heart has a richer array of resources, videos and audios and information about my coaching offerings. I have all that on display there.
Okay, great. The other thing I thought would be worth mentioning is anybody who lives in Northern California or the San Francisco Bay Area, you're the co-founder of Bay Area Integral, and I've recently gotten involved with you in that as well. And Terry and myself are leading a half-day workshop this Saturday called Living on the Edge of Evolution, where we're kind of merging our work together and exploring new things with a very strong collective emphasis. So I just want to let anybody know about that who lives in this part of the world. And to learn about that, you go to BayAreaIntegral.com. That's BayAreaIntegral.com, and you can find links to info on that.
Yeah, thank you, Craig. And we should mention that we are planning to start an ongoing practice community in the Bay Area that we're going to co-teach starting in mid-March called Awakening Together, and there's a website on that too.
Yeah, right. You can go to awakeningtogethercourse.com. That's awakeningtogethercourse.com to learn about this if you're interested in, again, this is just local stuff here in the Bay Area of Northern California, but if you're somewhere around here and you're looking for integral evolutionary spiritual community, we're going to do something really exciting over the next 9 months, so you can check it out. All right. Well, before we get into the Q&A, first let me tell you how to do that. If you have a question for Terry, simply send us that question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line number and press *2 to let us know you have a question. That's not the Maestro conference number, which Maestro is what we use for the Evolutionary Cafe, which will start in about half an hour. after we finish this. So before we take your questions, though, I have a few words from our sponsors to let you know about, these great folks who've made all this possible, allowing us to present all this information for free. The first is Gaia Community. Thanks to our partners at Gaia Community, an online sanctuary of nearly 300,000 seekers, artists, and visionaries committed to inspiring and empowering each other to live lives of purpose and authenticity. And they've also launched Gaia Soulmates, which is a fledgling dating site for singles seeking a partner who shares their values of spiritual awareness and personal inquiry. You can learn about both of those at Gaia.com. That's G-A-I-A.com. I also want to let you know that registration is now open for the spring session of my 9-week Integral Enlightenment telecourse starting in April. If you're interested in diving deeper into what it means to live an evolutionary life and discovering what it means to put evolutionary spirituality into practice, you can learn more about this and other upcoming course offerings at academyforevolutionaries.com. That's academyforevolutionaries.com. And if you're enjoying this series, you'll also probably want to check out Women on the Edge of Evolution. It's a free online teleseminar series very much like this one, except it's for women only. Join 21 of the world's leading thinkers, scientists, spiritual luminaries, and agents of cultural change for an unprecedented conversation about women's role in shaping the future. 45,000 women are already participating in this dynamic online community. And you can register for free today at womenontheedgeofevolution.com. That's womenontheedgeofevolution.com. And one last event to tell you about, which is the Integral Education and Sustainability Seminar, August 3rd through 8th of this year at Mount Madonna, which is also near the Bay Area. If you've ever wished you could dive deeper into the actual application of an integral perspective to education and or ecology, you may want to check this out with over 20 of today's top integral teachers, including Diane Hamilton, Sean Esbjorn Hargens, Terry Patton, myself, Claire Zammit, and Stefan Martineau, all coming together for the first time ever in a double stream seminar exploring the depth and breadth of awareness required to affect positive change in these times. For more information, visit www.i-edu.org. That's i-edu.org. Or just go to nextstepintegral.org, and you can find a link on their homepage. All right. So that's it for our sponsorship mentions. If you have a question, simply send us that question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line number and press *2 to let us know you have a question. So I will now jump over to the caller interface. So we'll start by taking a live call or two. Have a question from somebody in Newport, Oregon. You are on the line. I don't have your name, but I have your location. Okay. Hi.
Hi. My name's Heidi.
Hi, Heidi.
And it's a comment and then actually to request maybe some things being to talk a little bit more about it. It's that one of the things that I didn't hear during the conversation, which for me is really important, is where we utilize our freedom of choice in absolutely everything that we do. And that when it is aligned with that impulse towards life, towards evolution, towards something bigger than we are, it actually does take us on that journey. And we might not always be awake to it, but I would actually just have you maybe talk about that, because I didn't hear it in that terminology, and I feel it's really important.
Which terminology in particular, the journey?
No, just in our choices, that actually we actually have choice all of the time. It's like everything that we do, life brings us moments to choose. And that choice actually is, for me, how I see it, is that choice that we have has to do with, do I make a choice based on something that's just all about me? and that would be the, you know, egotistical type of choice? Or can I make a choice that's based on something bigger than me? And whenever we can expand our thought process that encompasses something bigger than an egotistical choice, it actually has a very big effect on the impulse that you're talking about.
Yes.
It's very powerful.
Yes, it's true. In fact, that's one of the main dimensions of an integral or an evolutionary practice, and I really think any spiritual practice is acting on the basis of what you understand. And any time you interrupt the unconscious automaticity of your unenlightened pattern, you actually liberate energy and attention for the evolutionary process. And not only that, you create a different kind of counter momentum in the being. So it's one of the secrets of personal growth is to constantly break your unconscious habits and liberate your energy and attention by doing so. And some of that is about how it changes you, which is what I was speaking to, but then there's also the dimension of how you affect others and how you make more responsible choices and how you become a better planetary citizen and a better environmentalist and all the other things. So I totally agree.
Great.
Thank you.
I
have one other thing is that when we do that and we actually make choices that are based on something greater than ourselves, how I see it is that it actually opens up energetically in a spacious way something new to happen, something that we didn't think about. So it's like that is the service. You know, that little time when we say, yes, okay, let me move beyond myself for this choice. And it doesn't have to be anything big. It can be little choices that we're making all of the time during our day. When we do that, it's like an invitation for that light to come in because we create a space for that impulse that wasn't there before. And we create that space actually in the physical form.
Great. Thank you for your comment and your questions. Really appreciate it, Heidi. Okay. Take care. Great. All right. We've got a caller on from Denver, Colorado. Hi.
Oh, hi, Craig. Hi, Jerry. It's Melanie. I was listening to her question, and the thing I've been playing with as my own evolution and transformation unfolds is this idea of freedom, and I'm always making a choice, but it's from where am I making that choice? And I'm really, oh God, I'm passionate about finding a place to come from that's different than all of the conditioned limits and behaviors. I mean, to make a choice. Yeah, we've got the freedom everywhere, but from where am I making that choice? Is there any kind of sense that you heard in that question?
I definitely heard some sense in that question. I think that this focus on choice and transformation is an interesting one for us to land on, because it really is often about choices, but it's important not to skip over the most fundamental choice, which is a heart choice. And the places where we're shut down in our feeling really are generative of so much of what else follows. So to me, focusing too much on choice and not focusing on love, on focusing on a devotional life, can put the cart before the horse. We need to choose, and we need to love and to open and to be connected to what is most attractive. And it's really been my positive, you know, ecstatic, loving, happy connection to what's drawing me, that's enabled me to make the choices. So to the degree that we try to make those choices without that connection, we can kind of bleed ourselves dry. And that's a really important thing not to do, not to couch this so it becomes kind of Calvinistic, dutiful. Yep, got to do this for evolution, got to make the right choices, got to recycle. You know, pretty soon we're like prunes, you know. it's not the way.
There will be no fun for evolutionaries.
The beatings will continue until
that's right.
Morale improves, right? Well, maybe on the I'm just in this place of like moment to moment, being connected to. I don't even know how to say it. I'm having moments and experiences of freedom when I am connected to what I call that source presence, and that's a place that I have had to work from fear. And the fear has been triggered from stuff way in the past, but triggered here in the present. And I'm telling you, it's been like terror. But it's one of the things is being willing to be there in the presence of my own fear. And I feel like something has been burning off and dropping away. So that's why I'm thinking about from where I'm making the choice. I am interested in absolute freedom from this conditioned baloney.
Yes.
I mean, that's it.
That's beautiful. I feel you in the process in all that. That's fantastic. In some ways, you know, it's going to be an individual journey for each of us, and there are aspects of this that we can share about and inspire each other and learn from each other, but we're each going to have to apply it in an entirely unique set of circumstances, even just the way we're configured, you know, socially, psycho-spiritually. So there's a kind of way that it's going to be a special joy and a special ordeal for you that I can get to a certain extent, to another extent, I can just cheer you on. And I found myself wanting to cheer you on as you described that last piece more than to give you advice.
Sometimes I feel like Truman in the Truman Show. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Jim Carrey, when he finally breaks through that fake seawall and sky and everybody around the
right.
world is cheering him on. I'm kind of like the female Jim Carrey. So
right.
Cheer me on, guys. Thank you.
Hey, right. We're cheering
absolutely.
You. Thank you for your call.
Thank
Take
you.
Care. Bye-bye. All right. I'm going to just we have questions also coming in through instant message, so I'll take a few of those here. Angela in Kamloops, BC, says, how do we know if the sense of evolutionary urgency we feel is real, and how do we pace ourselves to avoid a spiritual emotional burnout? Carrie and I were just talking about this earlier this afternoon when we were talking about this call. Solid.
Yeah, I actually, you know, you made a beautiful confession when we were talking, Craig. Why don't you offer that, and I'll respond. I think that was, we were just beginning to get into this question, and now's the time to do it.
Well, okay, so she's got two questions. One, why don't you take her first one, then I'll jump onto her second one. So her first one is, how do you know if the sense of evolutionary urgency you feel is real? This is your night.
Oh, how do you know if it's real?
I think that
you just have to, you don't have to know, see, defining it, is it a pre-urgency or a post-urgency? If it's a pre-urgency, I'm going to ignore it. If it's a post-urgency, I'm going to act on it. No, I think we just have to feel if it's healthy. What is...
Where is it taking us? Is it a good?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that sense that urgency is a healthy thing, well, we go with it. But if we keep falling into a sense of problem and dilemma and all the rest, we have also a work to do that is more like the ancient spiritual paths have always oriented us to. And generally, we have some of both kinds of work. I see them as a kind of braided unity. So I don't think that second-guessing ourselves is so much the point. I do think that we can get into a overcare, a kind of hand-wringing, overwrought, anxiety-based
oh, the world's really in a mess. I can't stand it. I feel scared. I've got to do something now about it. How can you just stand there when terrible things are happening? You know, that is unhealthy. You know, if your sense of urgency is draining you, well, you know, that's the acid test. If you feel enlivened by it, work with it. If you feel dragged down by it, question it. Practice in any case. Feel that you have a date eventually with a kind of relevance and meaning and contribution that's going to find its way through you. But sincerely do both. Purify the vehicle and do what you can immediately.
Very nice. Okay, so I'll take the other part, or I'll start down the other part, and you can jump in here, which is how do we pace ourselves to avoid spiritual emotional burnout in the face of this urgency? What Terry and I were talking about earlier was, I was saying, you know, a lot of people ask me about this, and I'm guessing it will come up. And I was saying, I think for a lot of evolutionaries, what happened, you know, that in a sense, if we look at where burnout comes from, I think it comes from, like, the self that gets burned out is the self that's running on the limited energy reserves of that the personal self has at its disposal. And as long as we're fundamentally identified with the ego or the contracted self, we have pretty limited, life energy, life force available to us, and we've got to really live with a lot of balance and care and make sure that we don't, you know, overcook ourselves. But if you look at some of the great luminaries, the great sages and saints who have become sort of just living volcanoes or hurricanes of kind of spiritual energy in the world, you see a person who is no longer animated merely by the energy of the personal self. They're animated by God, by the divine energy, or what we could call the evolutionary impulse. And a person like that, you start to see, wow, they're capable of a kind of full throttle giving where is it coming from? You know, they don't seem to be mere mortals anymore. They kind of become spiritual superheroes in a sense. And what the point I was making to Terry about why I think a lot of evolutionaries get burnt out is I think a lot of those of us who are awakening to this evolutionary impulse in whatever way, we get lit up by a source of energy that is greater than ourselves. And that experience of being lit up, even if temporarily, propels us into commitments and it's accepting responsibilities and stepping up to a level of engagement that is beyond what we probably have within our personal energy stores, the capacity to meet. The problem is that we don't, because maybe we haven't done the depth of self-transcending, and surrender and real authentic spiritual purification to make us a kind of undammed, kind of permanent vehicle for this process, this unfolding evolutionary energy to flow through, like a vessel, a pure vessel for it. We fall back down into our personal self and into the mere energy reserves that we have as a personal self have available to us, but we're committed and engaged at a much higher level, and so we fry ourselves out. And so the answer as to how to deal with that is two parts. One has to do with balance, and the other has to do with doing the work of radical self-transcendence so that we can be consistently available for that greater energy to move through us, which then we won't burn out so quickly. So those were some of my thoughts on it. Terry, you want to jump in on that at all?
Yeah. Well, this is... See, everybody's always running into choices in their life, like, do I take care of myself or do I do this good thing that will help me grow or that will be a contribution to my community or be of service to my family or my friends? And there's always there's no right answer to any of those questions. There are just places that your steps take you to, and then you must take your following steps from those places instead of the places a different set of steps would take you to. It's not like there's a right and a wrong. There's a creative engagement, and we learn by acting, and we get reinforced
based on our capacity, and as we grow, the habit energy of our that we've established based on the learning the lessons that were pertinent in years past become something we can outgrow. We can extend ourselves more, or we can discover that we've always been overextending ourselves, and by extending ourselves less, we can do it once and do it right and not burn out. And we learn how to avoid burnout. We also learn how to marry compassion and zeal. We learn how to marry our local caring for the people closest to us with our caring for the world as a whole and the larger issues. We learn how to discriminate about our motives, how part of what powers us that we thought was pure was that we were getting off on feeling like we were pure, and there was an ego in that too, and we purify that. And this is a cycle of constant learning, and so there's a constant process of adjusting. So as the more that we're seized by a larger will, we're asked to be serious. You know, it's kind of a don't get mad, get even kind of a thing. We just have to get it right. We don't want to overdo it or underdo it. We want to actually act appropriately. We begin to be disciplined by everything we can feel and notice about the implications of these choices. And we become interested to elevate ourselves so that we can be bigger servants and do more, but in a way that is sustainable, that pays attention to the fact that we are flesh and blood, and yet which conducts a larger energy so that we become able to do things that would have seemed unthinkable previously, and we operate at much higher levels of effectiveness and productivity and inspiration and care. And so I hope that adds something.
Mm.
You know, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that question. Really good. Here's one that I think you will want to comment on. Martin Jufrida asks, do you think the group work is indispensable, that doing work within a group, spiritual work, I assume we're talking about?
Well, it's interesting. That seems to, when I hear that, I think, if I want to evolve and I try to do all the work on my own, will I really get there, or do I need to have interactions with others and with a committed group of other people who are doing the work with me if I'm going to mature? And I think there are a whole cluster of questions sort of adjacent to that, all of which kind of have to be examined. One of them is, you're interacting with people all the time anyway, or at least you should be, and a lot of your growth is going to be stimulated by people who only share part of your commitment. And you can get a lot through all of that. Relational work is essential, and it's just inherent. We're relational beings. So, of course, your practice is going to be with intimate partners and friends and children and parents and coworkers and neighbors and, you know, a whole panoply of people. If you have other people who are really committed to the same path that you're committed to, and you're able to work together in a different way, you have a rare opportunity. Most people on this call don't have that. Maybe will increasingly be creating it. It does activate something tremendous. But the degree to which you have agreement and the degree to which you're, you know, like the folks at Enlightened Next have a really big, intense, intersubjective practice. These are Andrew Cohen's students. That's a particular thing. There are people who are involved in, say, a Zen center. I know the folks in Salt Lake City around the Kanzion Zen Center. They have a set of agreements, and to some degree they practice together. They're not doing the same particular intersubjective practice in quite the same way that the folks that are Andrew's students are. And there are sanghas all over the place, all of which offer different experiences of mutual support. To say that it's essential seems to invalidate anybody who doesn't have that particular form, to say that whatever you do won't be fully effective. That's not true. But to say that it's not essential is to seemingly ignore the incredible potentizing force that can come from working with others. And that's not true either. And additionally, there's a process that we're embodying right now. We're in a virtual community. We're having passionate and committed conversations at the edge of our own commitment, and we're pressing ourselves forward. To some degree, we are such a community right here, right now. Is this invigorating something in you? Is this enacting that function? Is this an essential aspect of your process right now? You can answer that question. You can feel what that is. I think if we define it too narrowly, we end up saying, oh, I've got to do this before I can do that. I've got to get this straight in my life. I've got to have the architecture of my life right before I can really be living the right life. No, that's never the case. So nothing is essential except you doing it right here, right now.
Mm. Great answers all around. Thank you. Well, we're at the end, and I know a lot more of you had questions, and I would encourage you to take your questions to our Facebook group and put them out there and get into conversation with others. We've got a few thousand people on there really diving into the dialogue. So you can go to facebook.com and search for Awakening the Impulse to Evolve, or just click on the link in the emails that we send you that can get you to that group. So, Terry, I'd love to keep going all night. And we've got the Evolutionary Cafe starting soon, so there's more conversation to come in about 10 minutes. But I just want to thank you for everything you brought. It's really,
well, thank you so
really
much
beautiful.
For creating this occasion, Craig. It feels both like a friendly conversation of committed comrades and, you know, with everyone, the whole group, all of us comrades, and also like a sacred occasion in which we're invoking mm-hmm. something and trying to serve something that that is greater than ourselves, and that's the most satisfying thing I could possibly be doing.
Amen. Thank you. Okay. Well, beautiful. So if you want to learn more about the work of Terry Patton, you can check out his personal website at integralheart.com or integralheart.com, or visit integralpractice.com, where you can download a free guided meditation on the three faces of spirit. That's integralpractice.com. And before I tell you about what's coming up next week, just a few reminders. Again, if you're interested in diving deeper into the conversation, be sure and join our Facebook group, where you can participate in discussion forums on any of the topics we discussed today or on any other day. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/integralspirit. If you want to learn more about my work, visit integralenlightenment.com. That's integralenlightenment.com, or academyforevolutionaries.com, academyforevolutionaries.com. If you have any friends that you think might be interested in this series, please forward them one of our emails so they can join us. And if someone sent you this audio, or you found it in some far-flung corner of the Internet and you'd like to listen in on the other 18 dialogues in this series, visit evolutionaryspirituality.com. That's evolutionaryspirituality.com. And finally, I want to thank all the partners and sponsors who've made all this possible, including our event partners, Gaia Community and Enlighten Next, and all of our sponsors, The Shift Movie, Women on the Edge of Evolution, Feminine Power, Integral Incubator, Integrative Spirituality, Next Step Integral, Global Mind Shift, Elevate Films, I Evolve, and Bay Area Integral. Tune in next Thursday for my dialogue with evolutionary evangelist Connie Barlow. Connie is part of the dynamic duo of evolutionary spirituality, along with her husband Michael Dowd, who we had on earlier in the series. Connie's written many books on this subject and created the greatstory.org website. So we're really looking forward to this conversation. That's next Thursday at the same time. So now we're going to shift gears and get started on our virtual Evolutionary Cafe. Each week, immediately following the teleseminar, you have an opportunity to come together with a small group of fellow evolutionaries in a facilitated conference call to explore the topics that we discussed that evening. We can break you up into small groups, very much like a workshop, and then offer questions and guided group inquiry. To participate in that, all you need is a personal PIN code. We have instructions on how to get that pin and get on the Evolutionary Cafe. in the email we sent you this afternoon. So if you want to join us, check it out. That starts in 5 minutes at 10 after 7 Pacific time. So we'll be starting in 5 minutes. See you there. And until then, keep evolving. We'll go ahead and unmute the lines so everybody can say goodbye.
So long, everybody.
Oh, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Lots of blessings.
Bye.